Stu Does America.
Follow the show on YouTube, youtube.com/Stu Does America. Be sure to subscribe and hit the bell for notifications. Chris Jacobs is here from The Federalist. He's got the truth about the shutdown and the Obamacare premiums. We'll try to figure out why Graham Plattner's Nazi tattoo does not in any way make him a Nazi. We're going to start by doing the left's ballroom meltdown. This has been a lot of fun, this whole storyline. I don't know if you saw this. Donald Trump is tearing down the White House. He's destroying it. He is destroying it. Look at the pictures. There he is. There's one. There's a flag there. He'll probably burn, light that on fire next. And then he's got this, you got the other one here of the, look at the destruction of the White House. And the reaction has been swift, harsh, and super smart, as you'd expect it to be. And when I say super smart, I have to lead with Jim Acosta. He said, so any president can just start destroying portions of the White House? Is that how it works? Kinda. That's actually pretty close to how it works. The president can pretty much do whatever he wants on this front. You might not like that. And I do think it's shocking to a lot of people to see photos like, oh, gosh, you know, people knocking down parts, walls of the White House. It doesn't look amazing to a lot of people. It's, you know, I guess it's symbolic to people on the left who don't like Donald Trump. But that is pretty much how it works. The president wants to make big changes to the White House. He says he wants to make them. That's kind of the whole thing. Legal writer Marcy Wheeler writes, first, Trump's mob attacked the Capitol for the first time since 1812. And now Trump is doing more damage to the White House than the British did in 1814. It's all that kind of level-headed analysis you're getting from the left that makes me love them so much. Tina Smith, senator, says seeing the White House torn apart is really emblematic of the times we're in. It's interesting, and I think Donald Trump would kind of agree with you on this one. It's emblematic of what he's trying to do. You keep saying, oh, gosh, they're tearing these things down. Well, yeah, but there's more to the process than just the tear down. I don't know if you've ever watched an episode of any home improvement show, any house flipping show. You see the destruction happens and then they build it into something better. That's how this is supposed to work. And then, of course, there's the ultimate. Now, when I said smart and I led with Jim Acosta, you might have been saying, well, what about Corinne Jean-Pierre? Don't worry. We have her idiotic analysis as well.
So the People's House is basically being sold to the highest bidder.
Oh, really?
It is corruption at its core.
At its core, guys.
And I heard someone say this when I was backstage. It could not be. There's no greater metaphor right now than what's happening right now
in this country than watching Donald Trump.
Take a wrecking ball to the White House.
When I saw the image yesterday,
I was like, this is not real.
But why did they let him get away with it? He has all of these people who just let him get away with whatever he wants to do.
That's what he's been doing for the last 9-10 months. Like, mm-hmm. the powers that are in the D.C. are not standing up. They're acting as if they're powerless, which is part of the book, Independence. Like, no, you all have power. You all have power. Do something with it.
I mean, we're talking about the least independent person of all time, Corinne Jean-Pierre, whose job it was to sit here and toe the party line constantly. And she was so bad at it, she was constantly reading her answers. There are clips of her describing herself as a black woman that she's reading off of the page because apparently she can't even remember that. Also, I will note, for a woman who constantly read every single answer she gave while she was in the White House and was the press secretary, you have to love her saying that she heard her point that she made on The View from someone backstage, proving she's never had an original thought in her entire life. Bereft of original thought. It is completely amazing. Maria Shriver reacted to this too. This breaks my heart and it infuriates me. Hundreds of millions of dollars to build a new ballroom. Good God. And that, of course, comes from Maria Shriver, part of the Kennedy clan, tied to Schwarzenegger. Someone who just knows frugality. Always can believe it from a Shriver or a Kennedy. Because that's where you get the frugality from. Jim Garrity went over some of this in his piece. Trump leaves his mark on the White House, literally. He said, first, those hundreds of millions of dollars, $250 million to be exact, are privately donated. No taxpayer dollars will be used to for the construction of that new ballroom. Earlier this month, Trump hosted a dinner in the East Room of the White House to thank the donors. Second, the fact that the project is privately funded also explains why the White House demolition and construction are continuing during the government shutdown. Because if it was government employees doing it and the government contracts, they'd have to stop doing the work. Luckily, it's private, so that can actually go on. And all the reporters that normally would be complaining about the shutdown because Republicans were responsible for it now have nothing to do because they can't complain about the Democratic shutdown. So they're just going to take pictures of the White House and complain about that. Now, none of this is new, boys and girls. None of this is new at all. This is something we knew was coming for a long time. Trump talked about it early on when he was coming in to the White House. He talked to Glenn about it. We discussed that on the radio when that happened. Also, he released a statement about it in July. White House announces ballroom construction to begin. This is the statement that they posted online about that. So this is not new, not some big shock, not some big surprise. It is something that we knew for a long time. Now, it is, I will say, a little different. And I will give a little bit of grace to people who are not necessarily tuned into all this stuff on a day-to-day basis, because it is a shocking project in some ways. It is a very large ballroom. It is like almost like adding another West Wing or East Wing to the White House. It's a gigantic chunk of the White House. And it's not necessarily the way this has always been done. Ed Lengel, who served as a chief historian for the White House historical situation from 2016 to 2018, told The Hill that even Trump's previous changes, such as the installation of flagpoles on the North and South Lawn and the redirect decoration of the Oval Office and changes to the Rose Garden, were nothing unusual, and that presidents through history have put their own personal stamp on the White House. The thing that is unprecedented about this is the construction of the ballroom. There's never been anything like that before, and I think I can say with total confidence there's never been anything on that scale or even close to that scale has ever been done before. Now, of course, the East Wing and the West Wing were built, and they're pretty big too. But the point, I think, is actually somewhat legitimate in that if you are not following this stuff and you just see this giant new thing and you're seeing they're tearing down walls of the White House and that they're going to build this giant new thing, it might be shocking to you. It is kind of a stunning thing, especially because we've all kind of become accustomed to what the White House looks like, right? So when it's changing in a big way, even if you think that way is positive, it's going to be a little surprising to people. I'm not surprised that people are freaking out a little bit. I'm, of course, not also surprised by the way the left is handling this. These people who work for the construction company who got this, this demolition contract and are excited about it. It's like probably one of the biggest deals they've ever received, right? Like you're going to the White House to work on the White House, probably a great honor. Well, they're getting trashed now and review bombed by the left. Demolition company tearing down White House flooded with negative reviews, which is absolutely unbelievable. Now, look, seeing the White House, parts of the walls torn down, there have been complaints potentially about security concerns, and that you can kind of see how the thing is constructed. You're getting more detail about that probably than anyone has ever had. There are complaints and there are people freaking out about it. But this is the thing. When you tear something down in a project like this, what you do is you build something back. The left might understand this phrasing, build back better. Okay? That's what Trump is going to do. And I don't know if you've seen what he's going to be attempting to do here and will be doing in the coming months. Let me show you some of the drawings and renderings of what this is going to look like. And what you see here, and we can kind of just flip through these as we go, is a pretty amazing looking structure that's going to fit very well with the structure of the White House. Now you see the White House, the classic White House photo you've probably seen 10 million times, and now there is a whole other building next to it. I mean, it is somewhat shocking in that way, but it looks pretty great, actually. It looks great. You see this hall, and this hall is going to be something that is going to be utilized by not only Donald Trump, but future presidents for a very long time. What they normally do with giant crowds when they want to do a ballroom situation is they stick them out on the lawn and under a tent. Now, obviously, in the winter, that doesn't work out that well. And it is something that will be very well utilized by presidents and future presidents to come. Now, when you get to the inside of this building, it starts looking Yeah, kind of how you picture Donald Trump wanting to look. Spectacular. It's glorious. It looks, I guess it looks a little gilded, if you want to have that description. It will be a beautiful, beautiful ballroom. And this is the type of thing Donald Trump likes to use to not just have a nice dinner. It's about projecting American power. And I like the tradition of the president being a civilian and being someone who is not necessarily ostentatious in the way that they do things. That being said, Donald Trump, I think, also has a really clear point here, which is you take over, some king from Saudi Arabia, I'm not impressed by your little house, okay? Projecting power in that way is speaking the language of these other countries, these leaders that are used to having that type of environment. They want to be in that environment. And if you're going to have this really, really nice ballroom, it's going to be impressive to people all around the world. And you know what? The United States should be impressive. We're the freaking best country in the world. We're the economic leaders of the world. It's no shame in being impressive. It's kind of this idea that we should be embarrassed that we have really nice things. It's completely ridiculous. And I, for one, would just like to skip ahead in this whole process. Because where are we right now? We are in that place where everyone's saying, I can't believe Donald Trump is tearing down the White House. He's doing all this damage. What a terrible man he is. Can we at least skip ahead to when construction ends and they all start complaining? The exact same people complain, I can't believe he's turned the White House into a gilded palace. It's so ostentatious and over the top. Can you believe this? This is where they're going to go in just a few months. So get used to it. Get ready for it. That's going to be the next idea. Now, of course, there has been tons of stuff done to the White House. The White House, it wasn't put there by Adam and Eve. Okay, it's a relatively, when you talk about that context, certainly a relatively new building, but certainly has been added on to many, many times. Long before Trump, other presidents made massive renovations to the White House. See what's changed from over the years. This is from the New York Post. An Irish-born architect named James Hoban oversaw Burning of Washington reconstruction, which reached completion in 1817. He was quite the expert. He went on and on and on, kicked off the work in 1792, wrapped in 1800 during the reconstruction. He worked alongside an architect named Benjamin Henry Latrobe. Hoban credited for adding the South Portico in 1824 and the North Portico in 1829. Okay, you're like, okay, that's reconstruction needed to be done. True, that's not the only time. The Roosevelts were big on this. President Theodore Roosevelt tapped the architect Charles F. McKim to usher in a new era for the White House. Most notably, the work brought about the famed West Wing, which today houses the Oval Office. The time of the expansion, the temporary executive office, as it was then known, was the executive office building for the president's staff, though not Roosevelt himself, who had a workroom. The Oval Office arrived in 1909 when the size of the West Wing was doubled. So again, massive, massive expansion. We'll show you the scale of this here in just a minute. President Franklin Roosevelt's administration saw the monumental addition of the White House's East Wing for additional office space and staff members to fill it. Came in tandem with the federal government growing during World War II. Construction was regarded as controversial during wartime. White House's most significant renovation came during President Harry Truman's administration. Engineers discovered the White House was in danger of collapsing due to weakened wood beams and outdated plumbing and electrical system. For a cost of $5.7 million, or $77.9 million in today's dollars, a total interior reconstruction ensued. Only the outer walls were preserved, while everything inside was rebuilt with the far more modern materials of concrete and steel. Even Jacqueline Kennedy herself was bored by the bland quality of the White House's rooms and embarked on a restoration of the property. Not decorative in its approach, it was reflective, as the work, she believed, had to center on the evolving character of the White House from administration to administration. But the $50,000 budget, $544,000 today, quickly spent on refurbishing the private quarters. Clinton had some of this as well. Compared to previous administrations, the Clinton family performed less work on the White House. Butler's pantry was converted into a kitchen for family meals. Oval Office received new gold tone drapes and carpeting with deep blue color. The presidential seal, its sofas were also restyled. President Clinton also installed bookshelves in the treaty room. You got to have some bookshelves up there so you can, hide all the sex you're having with interns. That was important to make sure you do that. Obama in 2009 renovated a tennis court to be used both for basketball and tennis. He also added a rug featuring a Martin Luther King quotation, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." And this is an overhead view, by the way. I didn't explain this for podcast listeners, but you see the overhead view of the White House grounds, and you got the giant house in the middle. You've got the two long hallways over to the west and east wing. And then in the bottom right, you see a room, which is two-thirds of the size maybe of the east wing of the White House. And it is the ballroom that is under construction. I'm not underselling it. It is a big ballroom. It is going to be big. It is going to be spectacular. It's going to be impressive. I'm not trying to undersell it. But it is smaller than the east wing. It is, it is a big addition, but it is an addition. And, one of the things I think you note as I went through all the history and all the examples from history of this changing is there is a thing that a lot of presidents have done. They've redecorated. They've added tennis courts or basketball courts. They've added bowling alleys. They've done a bunch of things. They've added here and there. A lot of those improvements have been things to help the president get through day-to-day life. Right. Things that are not essential to doing the job as president. But like you want to go bowling, you want to have a movie room, you want to have a basketball court. These are all things that theoretically could help a president just kind of get through the day, have some downtime. Now, we all know, that Barack Obama did not wind up using the basketball court. Or at least I assume so, because I've seen his jump shot. So I don't think he ever played. But in theory, he could have used that court for exercise. And exercise is important for a president. One thing about the Trump situation here, though, is an important part. What Trump is doing is not like for him per se. He believes it's going to help him do his job better. He believes it's going to help him hold important fundraisers or important, charity events and important state dinners and all those types of things. Yes, but he believes that's going to help him do the job better. This isn't a basketball court or a bowling alley. This is something that is going to be utilized by future presidents for events in that room. And that should be something that is a good positive change for the White House. And like, yes, there are a million rooms in Washington where you can go host events. That is absolutely true. But the president's time is pretty important. And the fact that he can just kind of walk down the hall to go to a big event, I think will be beneficial, not just for Donald Trump, although I'm sure he'll appreciate it and like it quite a bit, but also for future presidents. Here's the thing. President AOC, whenever she gets into office, and I'm sure that one's coming because, God, we apparently deserve it with everything we've done, all the horror show things that we've done in this country, she's not going to tear it down. Let's put it that way. She's going to wind up enjoying it. She's going to wind up utilizing it. I'm sure she's going to wind up bringing all sorts of corrupt people there to have nice dinners. And that is kind of the situation. I will end it with this, though. The Babylon Bee has a great headline. White House construction crew finds 1,357 more cocaine stashes. So we know a little Hunter Biden sticking around the White House. Congratulations for him. Even when he's out of office, he's still, in office or at least, high. So that is what this looks like right now. If you have a chance, go back to the radio show and listen to Glenn tell the story about Donald Trump talking to him about these innovations at the White House. Trump was kind of as surprised as Jim Acosta was. Like, wait a minute, I can just do this? And that's kind of the answer to this is yes, he can kind of do whatever he wants. Now, to avoid whatever controversies, he wound up just getting it privately funded. And then, of course, now the left is complaining about that, too. But there's no tax dollars going to this. But he kind of can do just basically whatever he wants, especially if he has the money to pay for it. So that's the way this situation works. And Glenn's retelling of Trump giving him that information is really, really funny. But he explained and went into detail about what he wanted to do and what he wanted to accomplish with building that room. And it's a fascinating listen because, I don't get to hang out with the president that much. I don't think you do probably either. I know we do have people in Washington who watch the show. Maybe they do. But to hear Donald Trump kind of go through this, this is his day to day. He's always got something going on. The one thing you cannot accuse him of, whether you like him or not, is that he's pretty busy. He's got a lot of big ideas and he's constantly executing on them. So that is where we stand. And we're going to have a big ballroom. And I don't know. Will you ever go to it? Will I ever go to it? Probably not. But it's going to be pretty impressive. And, that's not the worst thing in the world. frankly, for the White House to have something that is impressive and can bring people who are coming from overseas, who are involved in diplomacy, a place to go that isn't out on the lawn as they're walking around. They were talking about how women would wear high heels and then have to walk in the grass and their heels would just sink into the grass after it rained. Like, this is not how we should be treating our guests. We should have a nice place for them to have a dinner. Okay, Chris Jacobs is coming up. He's going to be talking to me about the shutdown and how Obamacare works with the shutdown. What are these subsidies? Is it true your premiums are going to be doubling and tripling? We'll get into that with Chris next. When sleep kind of falls apart, everything you're doing on the next day is really, really rough. And it just lasts for a while. If you're meant to show up for your friends and your family and your community, but if you're dragging through the day with a sleep tank that's on empty, it's not going to happen, right? You're not going to show up for anybody. I've had that crash. You've had that crash. Everybody has. But Dream Powder from Beam is a great place to go to make sure you get the sleep that you need. It's called Beam's Dream Powder. It is proudly founded in America. It is run by people who actually share our values, hard work and integrity and delivering results. It's a healthy nighttime blend. It's packed with science-backed ingredients shown to improve sleep so that you can wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Dream's made right here in America. It's made with a powerful blend of all natural ingredients. I don't know all of them what they are. I will say there's I know there's reishi, there's magnesium. Magnesium is one of those things. I never took magnesium before. I started taking it relatively recently. Really is helpful with your sleep. I don't know. Helps me with getting a deeper sleep. There's L-theanine. There's apigenin. There's melatonin. There's a bunch of stuff in there. I don't know what half of it is, but I do know Beam works, and also it tastes delicious. I really like the flavor of it. It is it's going to give you a night's sleep that you're going to appreciate. And they've got a deal going on, the ultimate Patriot discount right now, up to 40% off. Try their best-selling Dream Powder, get up to 40% off for a limited time. The discount code is STU to get that deal. You can get their best-selling Dream Powder for just $39. Go to shopbeam.com/stew. Use the code STEW at checkout. shopbeam.com/stew. shopbeam.com/stew. Use the code STEW. Get up to 40% off. We've talked a lot about the government shutdown over the past couple of weeks. And I don't know, I feel like, at least the coverage I've seen, we've gone a lot more into depth on this show as to what the policy requests are here and what do they mean? Where do they come from? What is the left asking for here? One of the things that I keep getting back from people, particularly on Twitter, are saying, oh, well, yeah, but yes, but our health care costs are going way, way up. In fact, premiums are going to be doubling. Is that true? I want to bring in Chris Jacobs, founder and CEO of the Juniper Research Group and author of The Case Against Single Payer, How Medicare for All Will Wreck America's Healthcare System and Its Economy. And he has a new piece out right now at The Federalist. It is conveniently titled, No, Obamacare Premiums Are Not Doubling. Be sure to check it out. I'm going to go through some of that with Chris now. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you writing this piece and really breaking this down, because I feel like a lot of people are kind of just looking at this and saying, okay, the shutdown is this, and this is a big news item, and they're saying they want health care, and these prices are going to go up. What are we going to do about it? Without actually, like, analyzing the claims. And as you point out in your piece, it's not just the people on the left who are making these claims. It's people like Marjorie Taylor Greene as well on the right. So give me a quick breakdown, a synopsis here. Are Obamacare premiums going to double?
In short word is no. Short answer is no, they're not. This is a misleading talking point that has been put out by KFF, formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is a leftist think tank. And they are focusing solely on the portion of premiums paid out by individuals. The government will still subsidize if the enhanced Obamacare, the Biden-era COVID credits expire, as scheduled at the end of the year, the federal government will still pay 75 to 80% of the average enrollee's premiums. That's far from a catastrophe.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There's you have the graphs in here in your piece from KFF. We don't have them all ready for you, but like if you look at these, you see, as you point out, you know, 78% or so of these premiums are going to be paid for by the government. The enhanced subsidies, and I want to get into what these are, but that would make it they're paying 88%, I believe, was the number of the premium cost. So the catastrophe we're talking about here is the difference between the government paying 88% of your health care and 78% of your health care. That's what they're worried about. And these enhanced subsidies are a remnant of the COVID-19 pandemic, are they not?
That's correct. And there's also a huge problem with fraud. And so in many respects, the talking point about premiums doubling is really a consequence of that. Nearly half of enrollees on the Obamacare exchanges pay $0 in premiums. And we've seen massive reports of fraud. The Congressional Budget Office and others have talked about tens of billions of dollars every year in fraud in the exchanges. Well, repealing, allowing the enhanced subsidies to expire on December 31st means that more people will have to pay something for their health coverage. But of course, if you go from paying $0 to paying even one penny more in health premiums, and you actually have to pay something out of pocket, on a percentage basis, that's an infinity percent increase, even if you have to pay $1 mm-hmm. for your health coverage. That's why the talk about premiums doubling is totally misleading.
Yeah, and you point this out in the piece, and I think it's an important point, and it's sort of like a nerdy math point, and we love doing those here on this show. But like the difference between relative and absolute risk is something that I'm always fascinated by, is the way it's covered in the media, where a relative risk number can look like thousands of percent, and then you look at the absolute risk, and it's like, oh, it just ticked up a little bit. There's a kind of a form of this going where we have taken so many government dollars and thrown them against these healthcare premiums, so that people are paying such small amounts that when the number goes up, it's building off of a very small number, which gives you this explosive doubling and tripling and quadrupling when it comes to relative numbers. But when it comes to absolute numbers, a lot of these, what you're talking about, some of these $50, $80 a month, that can be something for a normal family to deal with. It can be difficult to deal with depending on your situation. But to act as if it's going to, you know, end our economy and throw all these people out in the streets is a bit of an exaggeration.
That's exactly right. And that's the point. And KFF, again, I'm using their own data points. They said that the premiums would go up on average $86.47 per month for a household. And if you don't know anything about math, the median impact is likely less than the average impact, which means for most families, it's going to be $50, $7,500 a month. I can tell you, as someone on Obamacare who doesn't get a subsidy, and I don't want a subsidy and wouldn't get it, in raw dollar terms, I'm going to be paying a lot more next year than most of these folks are when the enhanced subsidies expire.
Yeah, and again, these subsidies that we're talking about were pitched to America as temporary pandemic measures, right? It was initially a one-year period, then they extended it for several more years in the Inflation Reduction Act. But we're talking about something that was pitched to people kind of like, you know, masks or keeping your kids home from school was pitched to them. Like, okay, this is a really terrible time. We've got a lot going on. You can't go to work right now because of this really bad moment, but it'll be over soon. And as is always the case with government programs, it just extended until infinity, I guess. So now we're supposed to deal with that. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. And you bring up a very relevant point when you talk about COVID and the COVID spending and what led from the COVID spending. Any family who has gone to the grocery store or tried to fill up their gas tank knows that the COVID spending led to massive inflation across the board. This is the problem that we're seeing with the Obamacare subsidies, because particularly with the enhanced subsidies, where nearly half of households are paying $0 per month in premiums. How much do you care if your health insurance premiums go up from year to year? If you pay $0 out of pocket, you don't care at all. And this is the problem. And these subsidies are actually driving the premiums higher and higher because insurance companies have no reason to economize on costs.
I think one of the scariest parts of your piece is the Marjorie Taylor Greene aspect of it. And, like, you know, she's not my favorite flavor of conservatism, but there's certainly things I agree with her on. But her appeal to this sort of populist idea, she's talking about her adult children who will have their health care, you know, she claims premiums double and triple, is a move that you're seeing now, I think, that more and more on the right, which is kind of embracing these ideas of, well, the government has to step in. There's an emergency. The government has to control costs. When you wrote a whole book about this, about the single payer program and what would happen. And I think there is a growing appetite, even on the right, for some of these bad healthcare ideas. Can you kind of explain to people, I'm sure you go through it in your book, how this actually would affect them on a day-to-day basis?
Sure, I go through this in the book in the case against single payer, and we're seeing this both with single payer systems and with the Obamacare subsidies. The induced demand, the old saw is true. You think healthcare is expensive now, just wait until it's free. And we've seen this from estimates of single payer, the huge waiting lists we have in countries like Canada and Great Britain. When you eliminate out-of-pocket spending, you encourage people to overconsume. You encourage people to, it's an all-you-can-eat buffet. How, there's nothing more American than an all-you-can-eat buffet, but think about that. Do you really, you know, is that healthy for people to be consuming all that stuff? It's the same principle here. And this is the problem we're seeing with the $0 premiums in as a result of the Biden COVID credits, because they are encouraging massive amounts of fraud. Nobody cares because it's all free. You're just stealing money from the government. But really what you're doing is you're stealing money from your neighbors and from the next generation, which is being saddled with over $38 trillion in debt.
Yeah, it's a free healthcare is not free. It's, of course, paid for by somebody, and it's usually somebody else, which is why a lot of people like it so much. We played earlier in the week when we were talking about this topic a clip from the early Obamacare era, 2008, 2009, of the Tides Foundation, a guy from the Tides Foundation, talking about, he says, a lot of people say this plan, talking about Obamacare and its predecessors, is a Trojan horse for single-payer healthcare. And I'm telling you, it's not a Trojan horse. I'm telling you, it's right there. That's exactly what we're doing, and we're going to get there. That was the justification for Obamacare at the time. They wanted eventually a single-payer system to grow out of this. First of all, how are they doing? Are they progressing to this goal? And number two, do you think that was the plan from the beginning? Do you believe that analysis?
Well, certainly. First of all, we want to say, remind folks that Obamacare is not delivering on its promise. Mm. Remember that Barack Obama in 2008 promised that premiums would go down by $2,500 for the average family. We just saw a study released today, again by the KFF, the Kaiser Family Foundation, saying that the average employer-sponsored plan, not the exchanges, but the average employer, if you get your coverage through the employer, the average cost is now $27,000 per family, for family coverage. Mm. That's more than a car for most families for healthcare. That's, Obamacare hasn't delivered. Now, you're right. Obama had said previously that if he had to do it all over again, he would start out with a single payer system. There's a famous clip, and I mention it in my book, from Jan Schakowsky, a retiring congresswoman from Illinois, who said that a government-run health plan would lead to single payer and put the insurance companies out of business. And of course, the left screamed wildly at this rally that she had when she admitted this. So yes, ultimately the goal with the left is always more government, because you see these regulations raise premiums. So what's the quote unquote solution to this? Throw more money at the problem. That's why we need the $400 billion bailout now to make the Affordable Care Act actually more affordable. It always leads to more spending, more regulations beget more spending, more taxes, more debt. This is a one-way ratchet from the left.
It is really amazing that the catastrophe they're warning about is essentially their own plan. It's Obamacare as passed, which is just a fascinating development. Last one for you here. There are some complaints, and I think this is true with some people, that, you know, on the right, we just complain, right? We just say, oh, we don't want single payer. We don't want this. We don't want Obamacare. We don't want all these things. Well, what do we want? A lot of people say, hey, what's the conservative plan? What's the free market approach to this? And why aren't we hearing it from a lot of our leadership in the Republican Party or on the right? Where should we go, Chris, with our healthcare system? Because obviously there are problems that do need to be addressed.
I think you're right. And this is something that conservatives generally don't talk about healthcare enough. They only talk about it when they're opposing a Democrat proposal. They don't put out enough plans in terms of specifics on what we can do in terms of an alternative. I think one big solution is portability. The problem where you lose your job, you lose your health coverage, that's a huge problem. And Obamacare was designed to get at a legitimate problem in terms of pre-existing conditions. It glommed on a huge system of regulations and taxes and spending that it didn't need to, but it was trying to get at a legitimate issue. I think there are better ways to go about doing that. The last chapter of the case against single payer, I outlined some of those solutions. I have another piece at the Federalist that I wrote a week or so ago, outlining some of those specific solutions. But I think conservatives do need to do more about this. President Trump, in his first term, offered health reimbursement arrangements as a way for individuals to buy and own their own health plan that they own rather than their employers. Hopefully over time, we will transition more to that kind of system. And then if people buy health plans when they're young and follow them from, take that with them from job to job and into older age, you don't have as much of a pre-existing condition problem because you buy coverage before you get the pre-existing condition. That's what conservatives should be promoting.
All right. Chris Jacobs, founder and CEO of the Juniper Research Group and author of The Case Against Single Payer, How Medicare for All Will Wreck America's Healthcare System and Its Economy. Be sure to check out his pieces over at The Federalist. You got a bunch of them you could look at, but no Obamacare premiums are not doubling is the one we were discussing here today. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the program and explaining all this. It can get complicated, but people need to know the facts on it.
Thanks very much for having me.
I am not a secret Nazi. It applies to me as well as Graham Plattner. Well, I don't know that it actually applies to Graham Plattner, to be honest with you. But I can tell you this, and I'm not going to expose my incredible physique to you to prove this, but I have no Nazi skull tattoos on my entire body. I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. In fact, I have no tattoos at all. But Graham Plattner does. And you know, look, this has happened to all of us. Every once in a while, you're getting hammered in Croatia. You stumble into a tattoo parlor. You go, oh, I don't know. Let me see this entire wall. I don't know. Which one could it be? How about that one? And it happens to be a Nazi skull. Happened to all of us. That's what happened with this guy who's running in Maine. Now, this is one of those things that I think the right is really liking. And they're loving. And we're all loving jumping on top of this idiot who has a Nazi tattoo, which he's now covered it up. He's put like a tattoo over his other tattoo, which is hilarious. But like, he seems to be the weaker candidate that could come into this race. So like, him having all these problems is probably is strengthening the stronger candidate who will have a better chance of beating the Republican, who's barely a Republican anyway, but still, numbers do matter in these situations. He's saying not a Nazi, not a secret Nazi. Maybe he's just a more public Nazi. You're not really a secret Nazi if people have seen your Nazi tattoos, right? So I think I have his back on this one. He's not a secret Nazi. Might be a public one, but not a secret Nazi. By the way, talking of other terrible candidates, Jay Jones, this guy who's running for attorney general and just was really hoping his opponent's kids would die. That guy is now losing. Polls show tightening statewide races in Virginia. Jones was winning for a very long time over Mayorkas, who's actually doing a really good job there. He is now trailing Mayorkas 45 to 42, so still a very close race. Close race for the lieutenant governor as well. Hashmi over Reed, the Republican is Reed, 44 to 43, so basically a toss-up. At the top of the ticket, though, you know, Spanberger continues to kind of maintain a significant lead over Winsome Earl Sears. It's 49% to 42%. Now, that's tightened a little bit from a 9-point race to a 7-point race, but it does seem that Spanberger is still the heavy favorite in that particular race. We're only a few weeks away from, what are we, 2 weeks away from Election Day? Something like that. I can't remember. We're close. And then finally, speaking of Election Day and the DNC, they're now paying $1.6 million more for Kamala Harris's campaign debt. Now, she spent $1.5 billion in like a few months. The DNC only has $12 million cash on hand, but they're spending a sixth of that on Kamala Harris' debt after she's already lost. She's, even after she's long out of the race, the race is over. The president is building, he's tearing down the White House already and building a brand new ballroom. All that's gone on, and they're still paying off the disaster that was Kamala Harris, which is completely apt. It is the most apt thing I can think of. It is a microcosm of their catastrophe, their ongoing flailing, you know, fireball into the depths of hell. So that's where we are right now with the Democratic Party. Back with more in a second. An absolutely unbelievable story in Politico magazine. Mom Donnie's ideas have been tried before and worked. Apparently no evidence of communist ideas not working in the history that we could come up with this particular article. But this is mainly talking about and praising in some bizarre way Erdogan in Turkey, which is an incredible incredible thing that Politico is taking up here, talking about how they have the city-run grocery stores. Erdogan's case, his conservative allies use subsidies and low-cost public services only, because that type of centralized control is so conservative that, you know, we all think of Erdogan as a conservative. When you want full control over everybody's life on a day-to-day basis, not really a conservative principle. I know that they like to, maybe in some other countries, that's seen as the conservative option when the liberal option is even more control. But in America, that doesn't connect at all with what conservatives do, but whatever. They use subsidies and low-cost public services to build enduring loyalty among working-class and low-income voters, eventually harnessing it to gain national power. This is supposed to be a positive? They're buying off constituents to consolidate power? We're just like, oh, that sounds wonderful. It's exactly what we want our politicians to do here. Istanbul's city, I just want to make sure, they're recommending we turn into Istanbul. Okay, just want to make sure you understand that. And the only time that it wound up happening in Istanbul and this wound up, he wound up losing control is because Erdogan's secular center left opponents adopted a similar playbook. You mean socialism? Yeah, I know. That's what they do. It wasn't Erdogan's playbook to subsidize grocery stores and food. Unbelievable. These programs aren't revolutions, Politico wants you to know. They don't come with Karl Marx boulevards or Rosa Luxemburg libraries. They're pragmatic, relatively low-cost subsidies with outsized political impact. Again, this is targeted to the left, of course, to say how wonderful these ideas are. But maybe the answer isn't right to right-wing populism isn't cautious centrism, but more daring form of left-wing populism. Istanbul's experiment suggests these kinds of policies are not only popular, but sustainable at a low cost. So there you go. Hopefully someday soon we can have an Istanbul of our own right here in the USA. Okay, so here's what happened. I have one of these, I don't know what they're called, like a mattress pad, basically, that can cool and heat your bed. And I will say it's one of the greatest things I've ever owned in my entire life. It is a life-changing device. Now, it's pretty expensive. The one I have is not the one that we're about to talk about. But the one I'm about to talk about had some issues this week. This week's AWS crash made smart beds overheat and get stuck in the wrong position. It's eight sleep was the issue here. But, you know, I will say this from a person, because I have one of these things, and it makes your, you can make your bed hot or cold. If you leave it on the wrong temperature, it could be a disaster because you get really, really hot or really, really cold. But I seriously can't recommend these things enough. They're just utterly fantastic. And, you know, sure, you know, Big Brother's going to come in my sleep, but, you know, it's worth it.